another day in paradise.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have Senator Walker, my understanding, and there she is. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2495. So I'll open up a public hearing, and Senator, are you here on your own, or did you have anyone with you?
They can all come up. I'd like to hear from John DeLorenzo and the agency if they could come up.
Is this one of those kumbaya moments?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
No one can carry the two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And it is a real kumbaya moment. And John Powell can take my seat as soon as I leave, because I'm only going to say just a teeny weeny bit. As you know, I've had a lot of problems with the State Accident Insurance Fund in my many years, and Ms. Rockland came over, and the world has changed. But it took us a long while to get there. I think a number of changes that have occurred in the agency have been tremendous for injured workers in the state. That being said, there were issues that Mr. DeLorenzo's folks had with the agency in terms of records, and we fought about that a lot for a couple of sessions. Well, now everyone is holding hands and has come to an agreement about what is a public record and what is not, and so I just wanted to be here to witness this moment because it's taken a long time to get here and a lot of angst. And I am appreciative of both parties who have really struggled with me over the years to make sure it all worked well, and they worked it out on their own. So I'm very pleased, and that's really all I wanted to say. This is a great accomplishment, and I hope that you concur in what the House has done. Any questions? No.
We'll let her off easy.
Okay, great. Okay. Well, I have the Department of Ag in my office to learn about safety of pet foods, so I'll go back and deal with that. Thank you very much.
We'll expect a report by the end of the day as to how the pet food is safe or not. I understand Senator Morissette was very concerned as to the death of one of his animals.
Yeah,
so.
Mr. Chair, he did lose a cat from unsafe pet food, and so because the Department of Agriculture is in my budget committee, I've asked them to provide me some information about pet food safety, and it's not in this committee, but I have some concerns, so we're going to bring that forward.
Thank you, but we have enough on our plate.
Yes, I think you do. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Hopefully, not enough.
Go first again.
We have on our plate.
Right.
You want me to go?
Yeah,
okay.
I will.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brenda Rockland from SAFE. I'm going to go first today and just make a few brief comments about the contents of this bill before you this morning, and then Mr. DeLorenzo and Mr. Powell will have a couple comments as well. Section 1 of the bill on page 1 is really the heart of this particular bill. It amends ORS 656702 to provide that SAFE's records are open for public inspection under the Oregon Public Records Act, just like every other public agency in Oregon.
Sections 2 and 3 of the bill allow SAFE to protect some
sensitive business information unless the public interest requires disclosure. And sensitive business information is defined in the bill as information that is not customarily provided to business competitors. And that would include things such as some pricing information, marketing plans, and maybe some financial and actuarial information. That section, though, also makes it clear that some of SAFE's records do not qualify as sensitive business records, and that would include dividend formulas, any advertising or lobbying contracts that we have, any contracts that we have with group partners, and any documents that would be subject to discovery and litigation. And that particular provision dealing with sensitive business records is repeated in both sections 2 and 3 of the bill. They're identical because of a sunset provision in the law that doesn't have anything to do with SAFE Corporation. And finally, section 4 of the bill on page 15 provides a definition for employer account records and injured worker files, which are called claimant files in this bill. That is language that the Department of Justice helped us write to protect those two types of documents that have always been protected under the law. And David Leith from the Attorney General's office is here if you have any legal questions that the Department of Justice should answer in that regard. And unless there are questions for me, I'll turn it over to Mr. DiLorenzo.
John. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine and am legal counsel for Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy. This proposed legislation and the agreement by SAFE, my client, and Liberty Northwest to support it is one of several components of a global settlement putting an end to a controversy that has existed between these parties for 8 years. I am here to touch on the key elements of that agreement, just for your information. In May of 2003, the Court of Appeals adopted its rule in Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy versus SAFE concerning disclosure of documents by SAFE Corporation. In June of 2004, my client filed a motion to hold SAFE in contempt for failing to comply with the Marion County Circuit Court's order that SAFE conduct a fair and faithful review of its records to identify documents that were responsive to my client's public records request. Following a 3-day hearing, the court held SAFE Corporation in contempt and imposed a fine of $2,206,000. At the same time, SAFE's then president and CEO stepped down, and Ms. Rockland thereupon was appointed to head up SAFE Corporation. Due in large part to her leadership in reforming the agency, the court reduced the fine by 2/3 and awarded my client its attorney's fees. SAFE then appealed the case to the Court of Appeals, which further reduced the fine to $24,663, affirmed the attorney fee award, but also affirmed Judge Lipscomb's order relating to classes of documents which were available and not available for inspection. The purpose of the settlement was to resolve all of the claims between the parties that were or could have been asserted by OSEP against SAFE Corporation. The components of the settlement consist of mutual releases by all of the parties, payment by SAFE Corporation of an agreed amount of my client's attorney's fees, an agreement by SAFE to not further appeal to the Supreme Court, an agreement by SAFE to not seek or support legislation during the 2009 session to sell workers' compensation insurance outside of Oregon, and an agreement by all of the parties to support what you see here today in House Bill 2495. Although House Bill 2495 will provide SAFE many protections that it does not currently enjoy under the rule in OSEP versus SAFE, the sensitive business records exception is a conditional exception which can be overcome if the public interest justifies disclosure. We believe that it is a fair compromise reflected by its sponsors, including Senator Walker, who have historically either been SAFE supporters or critics. They have all come together on this bill, as have we. We ask that you recommend the bill to the floor. And I want to especially take this opportunity to thank Ms. Rockland again for her leadership. She has done a marvelous job at SAFE Corporation and has taken an agency that was at times cavalier with respect to compliance with public records laws and has put together a very, very responsible organization. And we are just delighted to be here today.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Liberty Mutual, the parent company of Liberty Northwest. We're in full support of House Bill 2495, simply because the records, the sensitive business records, not only involve SAFE's information, but that of their clients, and we understand the need for confidentiality in many of those cases. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Questions for this panel?
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for, well, we had this discussion, it's just for the record. and Madam, you covered some of the exemptions in there, but I just wanted to, because it's actually sitting in the measure survey and or staff measures, and we have had multiple bills on this. We are, even with this bill, we are still going to be protecting Social Security numbers and those personal identification issues that would lead to identity theft. Is that not correct?
That would be correct under this particular legislation, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. Tom Gallagher. And is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2495? If you do, please come forward. Tom, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher representing the newspaper publishers. This is one of the many public records bills that are going to come to you from the House. We'd just like to be here to say that we're very supportive of this particular bill. It's exactly the kind of ways which we think public records should be handled.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Any questions? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2495, and the chair is opening a work session on House Bill 2495.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2495 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2495 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and Senator Walker will be the carrier on this bill, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2495. The chair is going to go ahead and go into the work session since I'm not sure if anyone's here, but we'll take care of that and we'll get right into the public hearing on 2490.
I don't do 94.
You don't have 94?
Right.
Who does?
Mr. Taylor's bill.
All right. Since Mr. Taylor's not here, we'll go ahead and open up our public hearing then on Senate Bill 274. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 274 has a -1 amendment, which we're considering today. It requires the governor to appoint the chief administrative law judge, requires the chief administrative law judge to adopt hearings procedures, allows agencies to modify a finding of historical fact by an administrative law judge only if there is clear and convincing evidence the finding is wrong, expands disclosure requirement for ex parte contact to include the assistant attorney generals who are not advising the agency conducting the hearing, requires the Secretary of State to use the Office of Administrative Hearings, declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And what I'm going to do is ask Senator Wissett if he wants to make any opening statements. This bill originally started as a bill that Senator Wissett had drafted, which was the 274. And then Senator Wissett and myself met, and what we have really before us now is the -1. So I don't know, Senator, did you want to make any opening comments?
Well, just briefly, you know, my perception of a lack of due process in our administrative law procedure led me to request the Office of Administrative Hearing Oversight Committee to be reestablished. And as no good deed goes unpunished, Mr. Chair, I was the first legislator appointed to that committee. After meeting with more than 2 years with the committee, after individual meetings with more than a third of the administrative law judges, after individual meetings with the former chief administrative law judge and the director of the Department of Employment, my concerns simply multiplied. The concerns expressed by the administrative law judges were manyfold, but they included the lack of judicial independence, the exposure to a no-cause challenge, which never has made any sense to me, management problems, including possible intimidation by the management, lack of training, and so forth. The concerns expressed by the public include the lack of due process, the ability of agency boards and commissions to simply change a proposed order of an administrative law judge, and the perceived lack of training of the administrative law judges. Some of those concerns have been addressed through the committee. A new chief administrative law judge has been appointed. Better avenues of dialogue have been established between the management and the chief ALJ and group of ALJs that work under them. A better program of cross-training has been established. But other concerns were not addressed, and that led me to introduce Senate Bill 274. And the original bill would have required that all ALJ determinations be final orders appealable to the Court of Appeals. It would have eliminated the no-cause challenge. It would require ex-parte communications to be disclosed, and it would have prevented ALJs from being trained by the agency during the time that they were deliberating a case for the agency. Dash one amendments that were introduced by the chair cover many of those issues, and I think that they've been adequately pointed out. As a first step in getting to where we want to be, all four of the original issues that were addressed by Senate Bill 274 were issues that were negotiated and not resolved during the time that when the Office of Administrative Hearings was established. They were compromises. And those four compromises have all resulted in some difficulties. Senate Bill 274 was an attempt to establish what I perceive and which many others in the Office of Administrative Hearings perceive as the correct method of doing it. The Dash 1 amendment does, as I said, addresses several of those adequately, and I think it's a great step in the right direction, and I support them.
All right, thank you. This is how we're going to do the hearing today. I have a number of individuals that have signed up in three different positions, for, against, and neutral. I'm going to bring up a panel of four for the first panel of those in for the bill as I'm going to say, as would be amended under the dash ones. And then we'll take a panel of opposition and then a panel of neutral, and then I'll come back and start again. What I do want to make certain is, based on the some of the handouts that I have for some of the individuals that are signed up for opposition, if you have not seen the dash ones, you may want to review them while the first panel is going, because some of the text that's in the written statements appear to be for the 274 as originally drafted, and you will find, let's say, remarkable difference between the 274 as drafted and the dash ones. With that, the first panel I'm going to call up is Richard Davis, David Marcus, Frank Mosel, and Janice Krim. And you'll need to bring one extra chair up, please. And I'm going to let you decide on who will go first. Just please remember, you need to give your name for the record before you give your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Richard Davis, and I am a board member for the Association of Administrative Law Judges. I am also an administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. I want to make it clear that I am not speaking in that capacity as administrative law judge. I am not authorized to speak on behalf of the Office of Administrative Hearings, which I will refer to as OAH. And to my left, I have David Marcus. He is also an administrative law judge. He is a former president of the Association of Administrative Law Judges. He was here and lobbying when the original bill was drafted and eventually passed to create the Office of Administrative Hearings. So he can provide good insight. He's been here a long time, which is
quite an anomaly.
We're here in support of Senate Bill 274-1. And an interesting thing, this is the first time I've been in this building to testify. And while we were walking in the halls, a compliance manager for one of the agencies, who will remain nameless, came to us and said, "Would you get final order authority already? Would you get independence from the agencies? It's just too easy to get rid of orders from the OAH." And that was just a few minutes ago. I thought it remarkable. I thought it really embodied the spirit and the thoughts of the public out there, that there is a perception that it is a public good to have independence from in the administrative process. The bill, as it's established, really for our purposes has four major points. I'm going to talk about them in the order of importance for us. The first is the relationship between the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Employment Department. When the bill was first drafted, OAH was placed in the OED. I don't exactly know why, probably convenience, probably to save some money. Whatever the reasons were, it seems to me the first step in order to give the OAH independence is to place a barrier. I mean, ideally, we'd like to see a standalone agency, but if that can't be done, to place a barrier between the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Employment Department. Keep in mind that a majority of the hearings that we do is from the Employment Department. There is a public perception that those entities should not be married together or should. The current statute provides, the 183.610 provides that the Chief Administrative Law Judge has all the powers necessary and convenient to organize and manage the office. In our view, that's pretty strong language of the legislative intent. Despite that language, effectively, the Employment Department has controlled the Office of Administrative Hearings for the last year. And this summer, the Chief Administrative Law Judge resigned based on the control of that. And I think that needs to be addressed. And the language that's in the current bill, while our association thinks is strong enough, there are incidental comments that I've heard from people in the Attorney General's office who are speaking on their own behalf, not on behalf of the Attorney General, but think this is not strong enough. It really does not put up a wall and that it will be ignored. The current language in SB 271.4 is probably not clear enough. It's probably not strong enough. When it says the Employment Department shall provide office space, hearing rooms, and administrative support services for the Office of Administrative Hearings. Well, if you look at it in context, that seems pretty clear. But there's still some ambiguities. As long as the Employment Department holds the money, which they do, they will have control. And so I would urge this committee to strengthen the bill, to clarify the provisions. You're in a position now to do that. If you don't, someone else, either a arbitrator or a circuit court judge or somebody from the Court of Appeals, will interpret the statute. You are in a better position to, at this stage, really make it clear what it is you intend to do. Second point, the appointment of the Chief ALJ. The statute, as amended, would change the appointment power from the Office of from the Employment Department to the governor. That's in line with all the other major central hearing panel states, and I think that would go a long way in creating the perception of independence. I do not believe that provision will be controversial at all. Third section, the changing of the procedural rules for the Office of Administrative Hearings, changing it from the Department of Justice to the Chief Administrative Law Judge. I perceive that within the AG's office, this may be controversial. There have been articles written in the Administrative Law Journal talking about the judicialization of the Office of Administrative Hearings and fears that the discovery process, which seems to be one of the more controversial, would just go haywire, that the ALJs would just wholesale start ordering state agencies to provide depositions and burdensome discovery. I think that thought is overblown, but keep in mind with the whole scheme of things, the chief ALJ has final authority within the OAH to rule on discovery matters. If the ALJ in any particular matter is going overboard, that matter could be appealed to the chief ALJ, who will now be appointed by the governor. In that scheme of things, I think that gives you a measure of balance, a measure of independence, and is a check on any thought that we might be going overboard. Fact-finding. There's a provision in the bill that talks about historical findings of fact would be upheld unless they were clearly wrong. A couple issues on that. It seems to us that this is a compromise between the final order authority that was proposed in the original 274 and doing nothing. And as far as the final order authority, the association takes no position on that. But it seems to us that this is a compromise and seems to be a fair compromise of the issues. I'm going to bring up just a couple issues about the bill as it's written. It talks about historical facts, and I am not aware of any definition of what that means, and this body may want to consider a couple of scenarios. First of all, credibility findings. An ALJ will take testimony often in person. They will have an opportunity to review the litigant, the individual, the witness, and make a determination as to their credibility. It is not clear that that would be considered a historical finding of fact. And I would go further. I would say that many agencies would not consider that a historical fact and would just overturn it. And I cite to you the case of Shank versus Board of Nursing, which is a case that we often cite for discovery. But in that case, they also, the ALJ, found made a credibility determination, which the Board of Nursing discarded. So that may be an area that this board wants to clarify. Do we want credibility findings, express credibility findings, made given the same presumption? Another issue I would address is the verbiage, and the verbiage talks about clear and convincing evidence that the record that the finding was wrong. And I take issue with the word wrong. It does not seem to fit any of the other statutes that I've read. Most of the other statutes might talk about erroneous, incorrect. You may want to clarify that as well. On the whole, we think that 274-1 is an improvement from where we are, and we applaud it going forward. We would like to see it even stronger. And then if I could pass the baton to Ms. Marcus, unless you have any direct questions at this point.
What we're going to do is we'll take the whole panel, and then we'll open up for questions.
Just a couple of follow-up comments to Richard's comments on two of the points.
Mr. Marcus, Dave, I need you to say your name.
I'm sorry. My name's David Marcus. I'm an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings, appearing here today on my own behalf and my own time. I have been an administrative law judge for longer than I care to remember. I started back in 1984, been associated with the Association of Administrative Law Judges for that entire time as well. Those of you who have been around a while know that the Oregon Association of Administrative Law Judges lobbied many sessions of the legislature for the Office of Administrative Hearings concept dating back to the late 70s. I served on the governor's work group in 1998-99 after House Bill 2946 was vetoed, and obviously the bill that we got was a compromise, and it was recognized by everybody that it was a compromise. And the cost issue was the biggest issue that prevented the adoption of a central office as a standalone agency. The other piece that I would like to speak to in respect to that relationship is that I don't think it was ever intended that the Employment Department would exercise managerial control over the Office of Administrative Hearings. But that, in fact, has been what has occurred. Particularly in the last year, there was implementation of what has been termed a new business model for the Office of Administrative Hearings that has had significant impact on the internal employees, but also on service to the agencies in terms of who can do what cases. More of a specialization, the involvement of a special panel of ALJs to deal with unemployment cases and with Department of Transportation cases. That has been exemplifies the fact that there has been this oversight and control that has hampered, in fact, the ability of the Office of Administrative Hearings to both be perceived as independent and to actually be independent in how it conducts its business. The second piece that I'd like to talk to is the administrative rule process. When the bill originally was passed and the office was placed in the Employment Department, there was a real concern because at that time, the model rules of procedure were in existence, but they were optional for all agencies. And the office was a consolidation of seven agencies that had their own hearing officers, plus the requirement that virtually all other agencies of state government, with specified exceptions, would also have to have their hearings done by the Office of Administrative Hearings. So the concern was, both from the standpoint of practicality for the ALJs and the administration of the program, as well as practicality for the practitioners and citizens appearing before the Office of Administrative Hearings, that it would make no sense to have a different set of rules for every type of case that was being heard. So the compromise there was that the model rules already in existence should apply across the board to cases at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And that made sense at the time, and once the bill was enacted, the Department of Justice created a separate set of model rules that are essentially uniform rules for the Office of Administrative Hearings. They differ significantly from what the base rules of the model rules at Chapter 137 of the Administrative Rules are. That has created a number of problems, and I think that the practitioners will speak to that in a little bit more detail. Suffice it to say that of the 29 offices of administrative hearings in states across the country, I am not aware of any office that is subject to procedural rules promulgated by the Attorney General's office or any other agency. It is the Chief Administrative Law Judge that is responsible for adopting those rules. It creates a perception issue as well. And that perception is both from the attorneys, but also from the public, particularly where an attorney general may be involved in representing the agency in a hearing. They come into the hearing, and the attorney general is prosecuting the case, and the question then arises, well, the attorney general is also making the rules, too. How does that play out? And it doesn't play out to look like a fair process. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Janice Cram. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing law since 1977. My practice is exclusively devoted to administrative law. Previously, I was the chief administrative law judge for a state agency. That meant that I created and provided the hearings program for that agency. I've also worked for several Oregon agencies. I'm testifying today on behalf of myself as a practitioner of administrative law with a background and with an experience in both the private sector and the public sector, and I bring those perspectives, both of those perspectives, to my comments today. I appear in support of Senate Bill 274-1, and I also urge that the amendments be further clarified to achieve what appears to be their purpose as stated in the current amendments. I actually have three issues that I'd like to address that are of importance to me. The first one, of course, is Section 1, Section 5.3. These are the sections that are devoted to ensuring that there is an impartial process for people who appear in contested case hearings. An impartial and independent Office of Administrative Hearings, which I will refer to as the OAH, is absolutely crucial to the public's confidence in the system and the actual fairness of the administrative hearing system. I believe these amendments help make that happen in terms of making the office independent. I was also very much a part of the original creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings. I participated in testifying and providing insight into how the current process at the time was working. The intent of the creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings was basically to have a centralized hearing panel that would not be unduly influenced by the agencies that were previously employing and supervising the ALJs. And in a cost recognition, the panel wasn't created as a standalone panel, but instead was appended to the Employment Division. This creation of the office within the Employment Division was not intended at all to expand the authority of the Employment Department to have control over other agencies' hearing programs. The Office of Administrative Hearings was intended to function independently with basically administrative issues to be provided by a supporting agency, not a controlling agency. Frankly, if you control how the ALJs are treated, you control the ALJs and you control the outcome of the cases that they hear. I think that the OAH's relationship to the Employment Department therefore should be clarified. I think we should remove any doubt about the independence of the chief ALJ and the OAH in regard to adjudication and the management of the ALJs. I think the Senate bill amendments will do that, but I think they could be improved with some more clarifying language stating that the Employment Department does not provide oversight or control of the OAH, and I think you can see that in Section 5, as Section 5, Subsection 3, as an opportunity to improve the language. The provision that the chief ALJ be appointed by the governor also would make the chief ALJ accountable to the governor's office, I think is an efficient way for the governor's office to be aware of how the OAH is functioning, and also how the agencies that are actually appearing before the OAH is functioning. It's a very efficient way to have the governor's office understand in a very easy and accessible way how well the administrative agency and the OAH are doing. I think it could be clarified, and I would look at Section 1 as an opportunity to do that. I think it could make it clear there that the ALJ is accountable to the governor and not to one of the agencies that actually uses the OAH for having their hearings conducted. The second issue I'd like to talk to is about is the findings of fact section, which is Section 8, Subsection 3. I have to say, based on my experience with administrative law that and administrative proceedings, that facts are best found by an impartial administrative law judge with expertise in weighing evidence and in developing a record. Agency decision makers, they're not trained adjudicators. Unlike administrative law judges, agency decision makers do not hear the testimony. They don't observe the witnesses at the hearing. They have an opportunity to review what in the legal profession we call a cold record, which means that if they even review the record at all they've got is some synopsis or an opportunity to simply look at a written statement rather than actually observe what happened at the hearing. It's my opinion that agencies should not therefore be reweighing the evidence, trying to sort through this evidence that they haven't heard and try to decide what the preponderance of the evidence is. I think that that's just not something that they're good at or that they should be tasked with. I think instead we should improve the section in the bill that and prohibit agencies from making, from modifying, or substituting its findings of facts for the administrative law judges. That's why I think that Section 8, Subsection 3 would be a good place to amend that to make that very clear. I do think that agencies need to be able to fix a mistake that is clear and convincing on the record. It doesn't make them weigh difficult issues. It makes them recognize something that's erroneous and be able to fix it. And I think that's a good balance. And that's already in the DACA amendment. I'd like to turn now to... Well, let me just say this. Agencies are really good at setting policy, and this, the Dashman Amendments create that and leave that with the agencies, and I think that's a good place for it to be. But findings of fact is really something that doesn't determine policy. It just is an opportunity for to let well-trained
professionals understand evidence and make those findings.
I'd like to turn to the last point I have, which is a concern to the procedural rules. That's Section 6 in the Dash 1 amendments. These rules affect how contested case hearings are conducted. These rules affect people like mom-and-pop store owners, engineers, dental hygienists, real estate agents, social workers, psychologists, a vast array of small business owners who are regulated by state agencies. It's important to remember that most of the people who appear in these hearings are not represented by attorneys. Nevertheless, what happens in these hearings affect their professional careers, their very livelihood, and their investments in Oregon's economy. These folks need to be able to participate effectively in the hearing process. They need to have rules when they appear before a hearing administrative law judge that are even-handed, that don't place these people who are looking for fairness at a disadvantage in relationship to the agency that's prosecuting these cases. The answer to that, in my opinion, is that you have the rules promulgated by the Chief Administrative Law Judge. As Mr. Marcus has pointed out, that's typical, that the forum that's supposed to be impartial writes the impartial proceeding rules to ensure that everybody who's coming before them for hearing has a level playing field. Now, it's not just that these are an abstract concern. Those of us who use these rules in our practice can tell you that there are very specific rules that illustrate how the agency is given an advantage, and that the unrepresented or even the represented person who appears before them is placed at a disadvantage in their ability to present their evidence and be heard on the issues that they think are important. I've included in Exhibit 1, which is an article that I wrote. It's written for lawyers in the administrative law section, and it gives lots of details and examples of specific rules. But let me just summarize some of them, because I know that you probably don't need a detailed examination.
Yeah, I think what we're going to need to do is review this. I'm looking at the time. I've got two more panels I need to do, and there are probably going to be some questions. So we'll review the article on our own, but thank you.
I would appreciate that very much. Thank you, sir.
Frank. Good morning. My name is Frank Massell, Chair Pozanski, member of the committee. I'm pleased to be given the opportunity to testify in support of the Dash 1 amendments of Senate Bill 274. I've been in private practice in Portland for the last 7 years. My practice is devoted exclusively to representation of professionals before their professional licensing boards. Prior to that, for the 21 years prior to that, I was an assistant attorney general with the state of Oregon, and I represented during my tenure at the Department of Justice, the Pharmacy Board, Board of Dentistry, Board of Nursing, and Liquor Control Commission, and a host of other agencies. I'm here testifying today on my own behalf as an administrative law practitioner who cares a great deal about the administrative justice system in Oregon. Let me tell you what I perceive as the problem. The problem is identified easily. There's one feature that my clients all share, and that feature is when I explain to them how the administrative justice process works in Oregon, they are dumbfounded. They are dumbfounded by this profoundly unfair system. The Dash 1 amendments go a considerable distance to fixing that problem that they perceive and that is real. When a health professional consults me, this is what they learn about the system. They learn that the agency is the investigator first, the prosecutor second, and the judge third. They learned that the ALJ, who will preside at the hearing, is a mere advisor, making non-binding recommendations. They also learned that the rules of procedure are written by the Attorney General's office, which is functionally the plaintiff's attorney. That's like permitting the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to write the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, and there isn't anybody that would agree that that's a good idea. I've provided you in my written testimony a list of the other things that they would learn. I want to highlight some of them. I'm certainly not going to recite all of them. But they learn that the agency has the authority to compel them to submit to a deposition while they don't have the authority to obtain any discovery whatsoever without the express permission of the agency, which is rarely granted. The agency can compel them, in addition to being deposed, to produce documents. The agency can compel witnesses to submit to interviews and to be deposed. And, of course, the client has no such authority. And that's a huge disadvantage for clients, because there may be information, either documentary or testimony, that the only way to get it is to compel it. You can send an investigator out to ask somebody to talk to you if they're a witness, but there's no requirement that they talk to your investigator, and so you simply don't have any avenue of getting that information. The other thing the client learns is that the agency can amend its statement of charges at any time, including after the hearing has concluded, after the record has closed, and after the proposed order has been issued by the administrative law judge. The agency can make its own new findings of fact, and that those findings of fact will be consistent with the testimony and evidence that the agency's own staff and counsel presented at the hearing. The mere fact of this overwhelming and disproportionate agency power results in a profound deterrent effect by discouraging people from challenging ill-founded agency action. And that's huge. That's a huge issue. The agency can fix any deficiencies in its case that are revealed at the hearing by the simple expedient of amending the notice and going back and having a do-over. Let me give you three examples, and I'll try and do this quickly, in regards that illustrate these problems. There's one case in which the agency proposed a civil penalty in the amount of $2,000. That's what was at stake in the case. It was for two violations, and the respondent requested a hearing, and in the course of the proceeding, the agency made a discovery demand. The discovery demand would have cost the respondent in excess of $25,000 to provide the information sought by the agency. And it was information that was unnecessary to a fair decision in the case. That demand was reviewed by the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it was determined that the demand was not appropriate. As permitted by the Attorney General's rules, at the request of the agency staff and counsel, the agency reversed the decision of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And that decision was made by the chief. It was made by the chief administrative law judge that this was inappropriate, and the agency reversed that decision and directed that discovery be provided.
Frank, I'm going to need you to wrap up, because I want to open up the panel for questions, and I've got a lot of other people that still need to testify.
Let me ask you if you would pay attention and give consideration to the other two examples, sure. And certainly in the Shank case illustrates a host of those issues. So if you would look at that, let me address one thing, and then I'll conclude on this note if I can, which is, I didn't address in my written testimony an issue related to costs, and I know from my experience at the Attorney General's office that one of the concerns that was expressed, at least during my tenure at the department, was that if you delegated discovery, or you allowed the ALJs to make discovery decisions, that essentially would have enormous fiscal impact, because they would grant lots more discovery and it would cost the agencies, and that's the issue. And here's the answer to that, as I believe, which is, in order to protect the public, agencies need to conduct thorough investigations that fully develop the facts. They need to assure that when they file charges, their factual allegations actually constitute a violation, and they need to have proportionality between the sanction they seek and the violations in question. And if the agencies do their job well, and most of them want to, many, virtually all of them want to. But if they do their job well, then there won't be a rash of requests for contested case hearings. There won't be demands for discovery because they will know what the facts are. So on the issue of costs, I think that, although superficially an attractive argument, I think is simply not well-founded. I totally support this. I hope that that the committee members do. It enhances the independence and stature of the office. It'll bring integrity to fact-finding, and it'll provide rules of procedure that are fair. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. I'm going to open the panel for any brief questions. Senator Romichi and then Senator Volker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a great opportunity to ask questions of this very distinguished panel, so thank you. I wonder if you could explain, any of you, I know you're all qualified to answer this, some of the agencies have delegated final authority. What percentage of the cases are you dealing with where final order authority is not delegated?
Senator Brzezinski and Senator Bonamici, in my practice, none of the agencies that I deal with, and that includes all of the health-related licensing boards, none of those have delegated final order authority.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, to my knowledge, most of the final order authority and cases that are issued by final order by the ALJ is by statute. For instance, in the implied consent cases at DMV, in the unemployment insurance benefit cases from the Employment Department, there is authority for an agency to delegate final order authority. I don't think that has occurred with great frequency. As far as percentage, I can't give you a direct percentage. That may be something to address to the management of the office. But I don't think there is voluntary delegation of final order authority with any large measure.
Thank you. I think it would be helpful for us to know what percentage of the orders are not final. Also, follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. Could you talk about the percentage or sort of general about who ALJs are? Are most of them attorneys? Are some of them not attorneys? Are they required to be attorneys?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, again, David Marcus, and the makeup is a mix. The ALJs that were consolidated back in 2000, there was a fairly substantial percentage of non-attorneys. I am myself a non-attorney. I can tell you that over the course of the existence of the office, the hiring of a new ALJ that was not an attorney has been an anomaly. Almost 100% of the new hires have been attorneys. As we sit here today, of the 60-some ALJs, there may be about 10 or so, 10, 15, that are non-attorneys.
Thank you. Another question, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you happen to know the percentage of cases in which finding of fact has been changed by the agency?
The answer is no, we don't know that. That was a question that was presented by the Oversight Committee to Andrea Sloan, who was then the acting chief ALJ. What happens is we issue orders, and we don't necessarily know from the agency.
Thank you for your answer. I think the answer is you don't know.
Okay.
I need to move this going forward. I got two other people that need to ask some questions. I got two other panels. So,
Senator, did you have any others?
Just one more. Would the change in the dash one result in an agency being required to issue a final order that contained findings with which the agency did not agree? Would that be the result of the change in the standard in the dash one amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that you may hear that as a concern that the findings of fact are things we don't agree with, but it's hard for me to understand how a final agency decision maker would know what fact to agree with or disagree with other than what an investigator feels the facts should be. So there is a process for exceptions to be filed so that if the staff has an issue about the findings of fact, those can be raised. Can the ALJ under the current system that we're the dash one amendments make a finding of fact that someone in the agency doesn't agree with and could articulate why it shouldn't be that way? Absolutely true.
but ultimately the agency's policy can't be changed by the ALJ. Perhaps the facts to which that policy should be applied may be something that agency staff may not agree with and may articulate that to their board or commission member.
Thank you very much.
Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but for the record, I believe you and the President of the Senate, and I didn't look at the bill in depth until I walked in, both you and the President of the Senate have a letter from me. I have a major conflict of interest on this particular issue, and since it's ongoing with two agencies, I just wanted to put that on the record.
All right, thank you. All right, I'm going to go ahead and excuse you all. Thank you very much for being here today. My next panel is going to include Nicole, Sandy Liebold, and Holly Mercer, I believe it is. And let's leave that chair up here. Richard, if you please, I've got another panel is going to be a four. And whoever wants to get started, if you'll give us your name and your...
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Nickel. I am the business manager of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280. I come to you today to speak in opposition of part of this bill. For the last 7.5 years, I sit as the journeyman electrician, one of the journeyman electrician spots on the Oregon State Electrical and Elevator Board. I have great sympathy with everything I've heard today, and I am not a lawyer, so I'm speaking to you as through a practical example of my experience as a citizen on an advisory board. It's been my experience that a number of the panels that when we sit on cases come up from part of the agenda on the electrical board is cases come up that were reviewed by or appealed by and included an administrative law judge. A perfect example is just the January meeting. There was 5 contested cases, and there was 5 different administrative law judges, and even in that situation right there, there was 2 cases that were almost exactly alike where the administrative law judges interpreted the rules and the statutes in totally the opposite. I don't blame them because they have no idea of what our industry is all about. And I must add that, you know, I know that there's other advisory boards in this state that have problems getting people to participate. Well, our board has always been, you know, had a full complement of dedicated men and women in a variation of our entire industry. I just think it would be a total mistake to... And I realize that this, you know, this is a lot broader than my little part of this world, but it would be a total mistake to allow an administrative law judge to possibly make a wrong interpretation and not be able to have it appealed by the people in the industry that know what it's all about. I'll give you another example. There's a violator that has been cited numerous times over the years for egregious violations that had his violations were so egregious that the agency had no choice but to take away his license. And the last one we had where he committed another egregious violation, the administrative law judge went against the industry, you know, all the work we've done set us back 20 years with by taking away our penalty matrix, interpreting the rules wrong, and treating this guy as if he was a first-time violator.
Mr. Nickel.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, Ms. Nickel, I want to just bring to your attention, what's before us at this point would not allow for an administrative law judge to, let's say, make a ruling on a rule, or some type of statute, but that would not take the power or authority away from an agency or a commission or a board to overrule that. The only thing at this point in the dash ones is dealing with facts as to what is presented.
Well, and so, I really must say that I'm not a lawyer, so I don't understand a lot of this stuff that you know, say in the dash ones. Not like the rest of these people are experts at this, but from my interpretation of it, it would allow them to have final authority on historical facts, and if I could be assured that that would include mistakes that have already been making as part of the history, I'd be okay with that. And another thing I might add, a possible solution would be to have the Office of Administrative Hearings assign a pool of administrative law judges that could just work with building codes in our industries, and I know you're under the gun, so I'll stop right there. Thank you.
Mr. Nichol, thank you very much, and we'll take your comments in consideration, and what I'm going to do is make note of these, and what we'll do is hear from the others and see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Senator Przanski and members, my name is Sandy Liebold. I've served as the executive director of the Board of Examiners for Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology for 8 months. Prior to that, I've held executive positions in healthcare and higher ed for 30 years in public and private organizations. On behalf of my board, I oppose Senate Bill 274 and its dash one amendments on the basis that it would compromise the efficiency and effectiveness of our board to carry out our statutorily prescribed mission of protecting the public. I know that you are under the gun in terms of time, but I was hoping to provide you today with a little bit of a perspective of our tiny agency as you consider the policy and operational effects of this bill and its amendments. Our board has the authority and responsibility to regulate the practice of speech pathology and audiology. Our board has two public members, two speech pathologists, two audiologists, and a physician member. And we oversee more than 1,700 active licensees with just two part-time employees. All of those individuals are appointed by the governor and serve at his pleasure. Our board has a tiny budget. We're about $330,000 for the entire biennium, of which about $25,000 is budgeted for legal expenses. Essentially, our concerns fall into two areas. One is that this bill and its amendments would appear to run counter to our mission as defined by the statute, and we are certainly in support of other efforts that are underway through the governor's office and the House Health Committee to improve the transparency, accountability, and effectiveness of health-related licensing boards. We feel that this bill could actually contradict those policy initiatives. And perhaps even more importantly, as I mentioned with regard to our budget, we're very concerned that changes to our current process could fundamentally challenge our ability to carry out our regulatory work. Although the Dash 1 amendments in Section 8 do allow for the board to overturn a final order issued by an ALJ, it does change the level of proof required for that, and we have a significant concern that the additional administrative and legal work that would be required to meet this standard of proof could mean that the board would be unable to do that. We just wouldn't have the resources available to do that. And the net impact of that would be to limit the role of our publicly appointed board in favor of decision-making by a single individual. Secondly, we have a concern regarding the Section 6 amendments, which, although we don't know the direction that would take, could significantly alter the board's current contested case hearing process. For example, if the process were changed to allow depositions as a matter of course, as occurs in most civil litigation, that would add substantial time and legal costs to our board's disciplinary work. Again, our legal services budget is very small, about $12,000 per year. For example, even under our current rules, just one recent case in which we needed to issue an emergency suspension cost $10,000, 83% of our annual budget. So we are really operating on the edge in terms of how much we could absorb in terms of additional costs of the process. if, for instance, we estimated that if only five cases per year required one deposition, that would essentially require us to double our legal expense budget. So in summary, my board opposes this bill because it would decrease the efficiency and effectiveness of our statutorily defined work by replacing the judgment of a publicly accountable board that has both public and professional members with that of an individual who is potentially relatively unfamiliar with the technical and professional work of speech pathologists and audiologists. It could significantly increase the cost of discovery in addressing complaints and concerns, such that our agency would need to dramatically increase our legal budget without necessarily increasing the quality or the volume of our disciplinary actions. And importantly, it could also dramatically lengthen the time taken to resolve cases that have an impact on the health and safety of the public. Thanks for the opportunity to comment on the bill.
Thank you, Holly.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing. In state government in general, the Board of Nursing is a tiny agency, but in the healthcare licensing field, it is the largest agency. We are responsible for regulating 70,000 licenses, of which 50,000 are nurses, 20,000 are certified nursing assistants. We have 45 on our staff. We have a budget of $9.7 million. We have 9 board members, 7 of which are nurses and 2 are public members. Our mission is to protect Oregonians, their health, their safety, and their well-being. And it is that mission that I would like to bring to the forefront of this committee. This legislation before you, as I'm sure with most legislation, has competing interests. In our world, in the healthcare licensing world, the balance is between individual rights of our licensees and the public's safety. And it is that mission that we would like you to look at. The Board of Nursing over the past few years, as some of you know, has experienced strong public scrutiny for not fulfilling our mission. We have had to look at our processes. We have had to scrutinize our business. And every time that I have looked at our processes and tried to come up with a quick fix, my staff has come back and said, Holly, this doesn't do it. We have had to do the hard work of looking at data, analyzing the problem, and coming up with the best solution possible. When this committee considers making a substantial change in this process, and what we are concerned with is primarily Section 6, changing the purview of the rules from the Attorney General over to the Office of Administration Hearings. We would like to ask this committee to analyze the problem in terms of data. Here is the data from the Board of Nursing. With 70,000 licenses, we have 2,100 complaints a year. We have 2,077 resolved complaints prior to a contested case request. We have 23 requests per contested case. We have 14 resolved prior to final order, and we have 9 final orders with 1 case appealed to the Court of Appeals. Length of process to get to final order. We are looking at an investigative process that can take 6 months to a year. We are looking at a current wait for scheduled hearings of 6 to 8 months. By the time we get to final order, in many of our cases, we are looking at a length of time exceeding 1 year, probably closer to 2 years. The importance to the public safety of that length of time has to do with the fact that in very, very few cases can we take a practitioner that may be practicing unsafely out of practice until that final sanction is rendered. So for a period of time, even if we notice that licensee for suspension or revocation, we are unable to take that licensee out of practice except in very egregious situations under an emergency suspension. The cost to the system. The Board of Nursing pays a Department of Justice bill every month of an average of $33,000 with an annual cost of around $400,000 plus. When I joined the agency a year ago, I looked at our Department of Justice bills and I thought, having a background in law and having been an insurance defense attorney and having been a general counsel for an insurance company, I thought I was well suited to come in and pare down those costs. Well, over 8 months, I have reviewed every line item of our Department of Justice bills, and I found one coding error and one concern on a memorandum. I have found absolutely no way to pare down our costs for our contested case hearings. I think it is very important for this committee to consider the balance of cost and what it brings to the public. Over trending, in the last 3 years, the Board of Nursing has experienced a 300% increase in Department of Justice costs and has doubled their request for contested cases. We have been unable to identify what factor caused that concerning increase in cost. When this committee examines the Dash 1 amendments, and of those amendments, we understand that this committee has spent a lot of time trying to reach a compromise, and we respect that. And Section 6 is the only piece of the Dash 1s that we would like to bring the committee's attention to. In closing, the Board of Nursing brings two things to the committee. One is an offer to this committee to provide data, research, and resources to provide assistance to this committee in its decision. And the other is a plea to this committee that if you consider making a substantial change, and we feel what is proposed in Section 6 is a substantial change, that you and we do the hard work together to base a decision on data and a firm analysis of the problem so that we can all protect the safety of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to open up the panel for questions, but quick, we can.
Just a couple quick comments, actually, to Mr. Nichols. The all administrative law judge or agency final orders, regardless of whether they're made by an ALJ or whether they're made by an agency, are appealable to the Court of Appeals. All of them are. And to Ms. Mercer, the Department of Justice general fund budget and other fund budget combined have increased almost 90% since 2005, and I think that is something for our Ways and Means people to be looking at. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My next panel is going to be from the Department of Justice, Ben Unger, Christine Shoup, and Warren Foote.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Ben Unger. I'm the Special Assistant to Attorney General John Kroger. Joining me on the panel this morning is Christine Shute, who's a Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Department, as well as Warren Foote, who is a Senior Assistant Attorney General. Chair, you'll be pleased to know that Christine's presence here is mostly to provide expert advice to me, because I am neither an expert nor an attorney, so she doesn't have any testimony for you today. Warren will be testifying as well for the department.
Great.
I just have a brief statement that I wanted to make on behalf of the Attorney General, and I'll say a couple of things. The first thing is that the Attorney General finds this to be an extremely important but very complex issue, and this issue first came to us when Attorney General Kroger was running for the office, and it was something even back then we realized that as you're running for a public office, you don't quite have time to delve in deeply into the issues that people were bringing forward to you every day. So as we came into office, our intention has always been to evaluate the way that we do administrative law here in the state and what our department's role in that process, and to try to figure out what's the appropriate public policy that will help protect the public, that will also provide a fair, transparent, efficient, cost-effective process for the entire state. And the Attorney General has always been committed to personally be involved in trying to figure out what the right answer to that question is. Today I testify to say that we don't know what the right answers are or what the right public policy is to protect the public, but that we're looking forward to that discussion and aim to have it in the interim. I think either as a complement to what the committee decides to do around Senate Bill 274 and its Dash 1 amendments, or as a part of some larger group that that gets convened because of the work that you all are doing. as part of that process, one thing that we're committed to doing is evaluating what the rest of the country does and what the best practices we can identify are from the other states around the country so that our efforts here mirror what the best processes are in other parts around the country. There are two things that I think right now...
I've got 11 minutes before this committee shuts down. I'd love to hear from Mr. Warren. So if you can wrap your comments very quickly.
Chair Brzezinski?
I'm nearly finished. So I was going to say two quick things. The first thing is that the Attorney General would, for the time being, like to maintain the rulemaking authority that we currently have, partly because we're only 2 months in and feel like it would be hasty, in his opinion and mine, to remove that authority before we have a chance to prove that we can be fair and honest arbiters of this process. The second thing is that a number of the client agencies, and Warren is best suited to speak to this, that we work with have expressed a number of concerns about the issues presented before us in Senate Bill 274 and its Dash 1 amendments. And I think, like I say, Warren's the best person to talk about those issues, so let me pass it off to him to address those.
Great. Warren.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Warren Foote. Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I represent 19 professional licensing boards, and I'm here really to express the agency concerns about the proposed changes based upon their experience with the current process. Boards are, first of all, very concerned about the transfer of authority of the rules from the Attorney General to the Chief Administrative Law Judge. The boards and agencies have observed a consistent push to judicialize the system and to make it more resemble the civil trial process. And they view this bill and the amendment as part of that push. They're concerned that the Chief Administrative Law Judge may be under great pressure to make the rules more closely resemble civil litigation, and that parties would use such a system to leverage results on behalf of their clients at greatly increased cost for the agencies. The boards have relied upon the Attorney General's uniform and model rules, as well as the manual, for many years, and they have confidence in the Attorney General. Transferring rulemaking authority to the Chief ALJ will, at a minimum, require substantial revisions and coordination to produce a similar resource that has proven to be so useful to boards as well as practitioners in the field. If changes to the rules need to be made, they can be made within the current process. Our rules are reviewed every 2 years, and there's a committee that partakes in that, and the Attorney General has committed to examining the administrative law process. Turning to the question of the changing standard in terms of the clear and convincing evidence, currently under the law, agencies may modify an historical finding of fact only if the agency determines that the finding by the ALJ is not supported by a preponderance of the evidence. A question was, how often is this used? Well, observations that the tool is used infrequently by agencies to overturn facts that are clearly historical. So that gets the question of what is an historical finding of fact. It's actually defined by statute in the APA itself. It's at ORS 183.650 subparagraph 3, and you'll find that it says that historical facts concern an event, whether an event did or did not occur in the past, or whether a circumstance or status did or did not exist. And the manual, which discusses the statute, provides some examples, such as the light was green, or another example was Dr. Smith began a medical procedure on this date at this time. That would be another example of a historical fact. But the agency concern is that most of the changes they make, when they do make changes, are not purely historical findings of fact, but rather they represent mixed questions of policy, in fact. And yet this is going to be a source of uncertainty and litigation if this change were to be adopted. Licensing boards are concerned that the new standard may impede their ability to define questions pertaining to the scope of practice as well as to the standard of care, and may press licensing boards to call or feel like they need to call additional experts to testify, particularly in matters pertaining to scope of practice and standard of care, because of the question of whether or not that could be construed to be an historical finding of fact, which we don't believe it would be, but nevertheless, agencies may react in that way anyway. I did want to note that discovery is governed by statute for administrative process. You can find it at ORS 676.175, subparagraph 3, which talks about the agency obligation to produce the agency files subject to certain exemptions when the notice of proposed discipline is issued. And that, yes, board members are not trained adjudicators, but they do have professional training and experience in the field. Most boards have a majority of trained professionals, be they nurses or physicians, and some public members, and they have a lot of experience in terms of administering the ethical principles as a use cases on an ongoing basis. So these rules may, in fact, they do represent a movement away from a known system of administrative law that could result in a loss of efficiency and could significantly increase litigation cost and may cause or motivate experts, courts feel like they need to call more expert testimony. So the AP has been tested and defined over the years, both by case law and by the rules itself and by just the daily operation of the boards. And so the agencies would ask you to urge to use caution before making any significant major changes to the present system, which has served the people of Oregon well. Thank you.
I have a very quick question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Foote or Ms. Shute or Van, are any of the hearings conducted by phone? Over the phone or are they in person?
This is Christine Shute from the Oregon Department of Justice. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, yes, lots of the hearings are conducted by telephone, particularly unemployment insurance hearings. I think the vast majority of those are conducted by telephone.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let me tell you where we're at. We've got about 3 minutes till 10. We could try to finish up questions for this panel. I am carrying over the public hearing to Tuesday, and we could have, since this is Department of Justice, we could ask them to come back. So do we want to ask questions now, or do we want to conclude for the day? And I have at least one other witness that's signed up on, that's going to have to come back. So
I can forego the question if you do give some time.
I'm going to ask how many questions you've got.
So well, I have several questions. But
yeah,
but
I think what we're going to do
perhaps,
then.
Perhaps we could get John DiLorenzo up here.
Let's do this. Let's go ahead and thank you all very much, and we're going to continue so you can come back and for questions. We will want you back on Tuesday.
I do have questions on Tuesday.
All right. And John, did you want to come up and make some statements? I'm not sure what your schedule is for Tuesday as to your availability, since you're the last signed up for testifying.
Mr. Chairman, I can do this in 2 minutes.
Let's do it. Yes.
John, just use 15
seconds. If you can do it in a minute and a half, then I can do my work session on another one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. Ms. Davis Wright Tremaine. I'm here on my own behalf. My involvement in this issue goes back to 1997 when I was the chief proponent for House Bill 2948, a bill that was adopted by the legislature but vetoed by Governor Kitzhaber. That gave rise to the next session of House Bill 2525, which is basically what we have here today. I'm here in support of the Dash 1 amendments. 2 years ago, I was invited to address the annual meeting of the Association of Administrative Law Judges. I reviewed during that meeting a case I had recently been involved with an administrative agency. We held a hearing before an ALJ. After much time and effort, the ALJ ruled in my client's favor. There was later a hearing before the commission to consider the ALJ's proposed order. After oral argument, the Deputy Attorney General adjourned to lunch with the members of the commission. We, of course, were not participated to dine with the commission in executive session. And after a very short recess, the commission emerged with a 15-page replacement, completely overturning the opinion of the administrative law judge. Of course, I was very impressed as to how the commission could, in that short period of time, completely deliberate and issue a 15-page replacement order. But regardless, my client was outraged, because from the client's perspective, this was supposed to be a fair proceeding, not one that was merely a doormat on the way to the commission. My chat became interactive with the ALJs, and following that meeting, at which time the ALJs talked about instance after instance after instance in which they had been overturned. The chief ALJ conducted a survey. He eliminated proposed orders. He looked at proposed orders over a five-year period. He eliminated orders in which final order authority had been given to the ALJs or when guilt was conceded and only penalties were at issue. And he found that when the ALJs ruled against agencies, they were overturned 50% of the time. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is very disappointing. It sends the wrong message to the public. That's why I believe that Section 8 of the Dash 1 amendments is so refreshing, to not allow this to happen with respect to the finding of historic fact, unless there is evidence otherwise. My only suggestion is that in Section 9 of your proposed Dash 1 amendments, you change the effective date, or you change the effective provision, not to only apply this rule to cases in which an ALJ has been appointed, but like Section 12, provide that the amendments will apply to all contested case hearings which take place after the effective date of the Act. That's all I have to say. And I sure appreciate you affording me this time up against your deadline.
I apologize that we have cut you short, but with that, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing and members stay right here, and that's going to be carried over until Tuesday, as I said. So Senate Bill 274 will be back up for a public hearing on this next Tuesday. With that hearing being closed, until then, we'll now open up a work session on Senate Bill 94. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 94 comes to you from the Department of Veterans Affairs. You've already adopted the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, which Legislative Council's office put into Dash 3. You have the fiscal and revenue.
Excuse me, if everyone can keep their voices down, we're still having meetings.
So the only thing the committee needs to do is to vote on the amended bill.
When you do Dash 3, there's no specific.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Boquist, the Dash 1 and Dash 2s were adopted. Legislative Fiscal Council's office, as a matter of policy and course, combines the two. We have the fiscals and revenues for the Dash 1 and Dash 2s. We don't need them for the Dash 3s.
Check. I move the Dash 3s into SB 94 as already amended by the Dash 1s and Dash 2s, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 3s into the amended Senate Bill 94. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, in light of no fiscal, I move SB 90, SB 94 as adopted with the Dash 1s, Dash 2s, and Dash 3s to the floor with the due pass.
Sir, Boquist moves the Senate Bill 94 as amended by Dash 1s, 2s, and 3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just real quick, I just want to make sure I understand this. What it's doing is taking out the emergency clause, right? Is that what the Dash 3s?
Mr. Chairman, we've already adopted the Dash 1s and Dash 2s. They did that. Took out the emergency clause, made some other changes as it relates to how the bills handle. You've already adopted those. The Dash 3s are nothing but a combination of 1s and 2s.
Thank you. Got it.
So,
any other questions? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see, I'm going to be carrying a number of bills. Senator Boquist will take this one. Thank you. And with that, we're closed now. Tomorrow, we're scheduled to be at 7:30, and we're still waiting for amendments to be delivered to us. As soon as they are, I will get them out to members. And with that, we're closed.